Recently, Chambers was announced as the winner of the 2025 Viva Award. Established in 1988 by Jack and Doris Shadbolt, the Viva Award is an annual prize awarded to mid-career visual artists in BC who demonstrate exceptional creative ability and commitment to the visual arts. CJSF sat down for a conversation with Chambers to discuss her reaction to receiving the award, her work up until this point, and what's next for her practice and career. To start off the interview, I guess I should just say that I'm here with artist, choreographer, dancer, educator, Justine Chambers, and we're here to talk today about an award that you recently won, the 2025 Viva Award. And the first question that I had for you was just, what was that moment like, I guess, just finding out that you received it in the first place?
I was kind of in shock. Like, it's like my brain wouldn't hear it. Melanie O'Brien called and she said, Justine, you know, I have good news. You're this person. And I went, what? She said it again and I went, what? And then my kid came running in from her room and said, Mom, did someone die? And I said, no, it's fine. I won an award. So I was just, I was really shocked. It's not something that was even on my radar as something that I would be, that is available to me. So I was really surprised and delighted, of course. I mean, I think for me, this award, what makes it extra special is that it's a jury of your peers. And that made me feel like a million bucks. Like, it just really, the people on the jury are such extraordinary humans. And I thought, oh my goodness. And it also made me go, okay, like, no, game on, girl. Now, like, step it up. I think that's always my first response to these things is, like, live up to, you know, if you're just, I feel like when someone, when you're given attention, it's a call to meet that attention and consider what else you could be doing, which, and not in like a strange, not worthy way, because I do feel like I've worked very hard and it's just lovely to be recognized, of course, but I also think, now you keep going, you know? So motivating, shocking, delightful. And yeah, it's very cool. I can't even be cool about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair. I like what you said about, you know, it's not that you're surprised in a way of like not feeling worthy of it, but more so that like now you feel like you have to sort of rise to that occasion of
absolutely
of the award. Yeah,
which I love. You know, it's always great to like keep going, like bring the A+ game, you know, or whatever it is, you know. That's I think that's, you know, what we have to do to stay interesting and interested. It's always more interesting to be interested than to be interesting. You know what I mean? But I think it makes me want to grow a little bit, maybe harder than I was planning to or something. Yeah.
One thing I was really interested by was like the wording of the award. When I was looking into it, it said that like the Viva Award was established and is labeled as being a prize awarded to mid-career visual artists in BC. Is that a label that you would agree with or subscribe to? Like, do you see, especially in the context of a career that involves creative expression, do you see your career as having like a fixed start and end?
Oof, that is such, I mean, there's many debates about these things. And I think, you know, if we, you know, I am definitely mid-century at this moment of my life. So in that way, I'm like, you know, assuming that I'll live to 100, then yes, it's mid-career. But then also, I don't know. It's hard to think about being in the middle of anything, right? You know, like you said, there's this like kind of this sort of protracted continuum that we all feel like we're on. It may be, you know, I think that that's a really tough question, because like, when are we mid-career, right? And you know, in some places it would be like, oh, if you're no longer emerging, you're mid-career. But yeah, I mean, I just hope that, yeah, I would love for this to be mid-career. I'll put it that way, because I think like, ooh, really? Am I going to keep working all the way until I'm 100? But maybe I will. Like, who knows, right? But Maybe in the realm of visual arts, I'm more mid-career than I am in dance. Maybe that's a better way of putting it if I think about it that way. You know, like I started dancing professionally when I was 18, so I think that, but my sort of my relationship with visual arts, I think, showed up like in the 2009, 2010, so maybe in that way it is. I mean, it's just even wild to say career at this point in my life. I don't think that I even, when I started to dance, when I decided that I was going to be a dancer, I don't think I could even see, you know, further than 2 years ahead, you know? But then now I can look back over 30 years and go, okay, maybe I did have a career, you know? Like, I did make it a career somehow. Like, how do we do these things? Because, you know, this never has always, it's, you know, there are so many talented artists everywhere, all over the world, right? And it's not, we don't always have like the right timing or the right opportunities or the right means to keep going. And I guess it makes me maybe in that sort of, now it makes me feel like I'm way past mid-career when I can look back and be like, wow, I had the support to do it. But yeah, mid-career. I also paused when I read that, I will say.
Yeah, because who gets to define that, right? That was something I was very curious about.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny because I think about like how granting bodies kind of define that. You know, it's like, are you emerging? Are you mid-career? Are you senior? Sorry about that noise. It's my SFU email. I don't know how to turn off that notification. Maybe that shows me as like a really mid-career. So I think that, yeah, maybe those things are defined by our support systems or the structures that allow us to keep going. But for myself, sometimes I feel like I'm just figuring things out now.
Mm-hmm. You know, just in preparing for this interview, I feel like I sort of gave myself like a crash course on just contemporary dance as a whole. Because like, admittedly, it's not a medium that I'm extremely familiar with. But one thing I thought was really interesting is like in a few interviews you've done, you've kind of mentioned that you feel like in your process, you're sort of making the same dance over and over. And like how it's, you know, always about like the physical interrelations of every day and its different iterations and things like that. But I was curious because that can encompass a lot. And I wanted to know like how you decide which angle to pursue that from, whether it's, you know, like doing a performance on the physical and social dynamics of like dinner parties, or more recently with the Brutal Joy, which is rooted in like Black dandyism and also your lived experiences as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, it does feel like the same dance. It feels like maybe I always have the same question. And I think that what, you know, the way I approach it is like usually has something to do with what's happening in my life or something that's recurrent, like a recurring thing around me, or maybe even an obstacle I feel like I keep coming up against. And I always think, wow, like I am clearly ill-equipped to deal with this or to think through this or to crunch through this. And so how could I build a practice that would allow me to practice being a human? Like, I think that is really what my practice ends up being, is that I'm like, okay, how do I stay tethered when I don't like what's going on? Like, how do I not dissociate or jump ship? Or so like, what are the ways I can stay with something that's difficult? You know, how do I stay in relation when the world feels impossible? Or how do I dodge this constant narrative damage that a narrative like this damage narrative that's attached to being racialized? How do I practice meeting that with something else? And so I think this is why I keep feel like I'm making the same dance in some way, because I think the questions are always the same, which is like always around being in relation to people, to places, to objects, to architecture, to the world, to power structures. But it's usually like there's like a little thing in me that goes like, ooh, I'm not able to process that as just in my own day-to-day humanness. So let me build a structure. Let me build a movement structure, a relational structure, a score, a choreographic imperative to practice that thing. And then maybe I'll have greater understanding about the world. And I think the Brutal Joy in particular, like the most recent thing, came about because of the 2020 moment and because of what happened to black artists in particular, which is, you know, getting a certain amount of attention and getting a certain amount, but then understanding that people really wanted to hang out in what was terrible about being black, and I did not want to hang out in that because we live that every day. So I was like, what are the things we do? And it's not about like black girl magic, well, it is black girl magic, but it's not just that. and it's not just about like black excellence or rising above something, this idea that we need to rise above. I'm like, we've been rising, right? So for me, it was like, how do I work on embodying and articulating through gesture and through clothing already, or this other thing that's actually what's important to me, and this other thing that has allowed me to be in the world in this like really dynamic way, and this other way that has allowed me to survive terrible things or boring things, you know, boring conversations or, and this kind of thing. So I think like that's like an example of like, I was like, oh, there's something, and it's so funny because I'm just realizing this as I speak to you, that's interesting. I was like, oh, how did I get to that? But also about self-determination, you know, how do I decide what is enough for me or what is needed, and how do we not always acquiesce, and how do we assert ourselves and sort of empower ourselves to be the thing or to be in relationship to the things we want to be in relation, like, or how do I refuse something? And I think that I realized, oh, I've already been given those skills, right? And they show up in how we work through the electric slide, and fashion is a thing, right? Like it's a thing. Mm-hmm. It's not trivial. It's not trite. It's not just adornment, right? It's agency, and it's audacious, and it's taking space and claiming space, and it's like taking a colonial structure and making it better, like we tend to do, you know. So so I like that. I think that's what I mean when I say like I'm making the same dance, because also family dinner for me was very much about how do you be in relation to people when your social codes don't match, right? And how can I like allow you to be yourself and still be myself? I mean, it's also connected to family, of course, but and then so we built these wildly outrageous, impossible scores to do while we eat with other people, while we still have to host, while we still have to do these things, which of course is stuff that we're doing every day, you know, like you forced to go to an event or a dinner and you've had a terrible day or you have 1,000 other things to do. And it's like, how do you be with yourself and the event and everything else? So I built these scores, which I think maybe are scores of attention, you know, that are around attention and noticing. Yeah, but I'm at that place where like, oh, I made Brutal Joy and now we're touring it. And somebody asked me, like, I said, you know, I'm ready to make something else. And they said, well, what is it? And I'm like, oh, I haven't a clue, but but I'm ready to make something else. Like, I'm ready to be open to a new idea, you know?
Yeah. And like, and that process comes, from what I've heard, quite naturally to you, right? Like this, in a way, it does feel like the performances that you've done serve as like a processing tool. In a way as well.
Yeah. They're just about me trying to deal with being a human, I think, most of the time, right? And something shows up. I mean, I am working with like a very dear colleague of mine on something which really came out of him saying like, I got no money, but I got time. And I said, well, I'm really lucky because now I work at a university and I have a salary and I got time and I got a studio, you know? And this is someone I've danced with for 15 years and is a very, very close friend. His name's Josh Martin. He runs Company 605. And, you know, and he's like, well, should we just start hanging out in a studio, you know? And, of course, it was hilarious and glorious and irreverent. And I don't know what we're making yet, but we decided, like, oh, yeah, let's make something. So as it shows up, you know, and I do love to collaborate with people. I don't usually have like well, it's not true. I do choreographic collaborators. Yeah. I think I'm not very good at I don't go into a dark room to figure out something alone. Like nothing cracks from my brain, like Athena, you know, sprouting from Zeus's head. I am not that person. It's only with other people that I can think through things. So whenever someone says, hey, do you want to like work on something together? I'm always like, yeah. Let's do that, because you're going to make my mind do things it wouldn't do if I was just here with a pen by myself being like, come up with an idea, Justine. It just doesn't happen. Like I'm a very, like, I really, I think I require other humans to understand things, you know? I'm not one to, you know, there's this talk of Martha Graham going into a room for however long by herself and developing her whole technique. And I can't even imagine how that would happen with me. I'd probably just watch Netflix and have a nap.
Yeah, I mean, prime alone activities, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. The way you speak about that, one thing I wanted to ask, because, you know, CJSF based at SFU, are there, like, instances or things that you can sort of pinpoint as ways your practice maybe has been influenced by the students that you've worked with since joining the School of Contemporary Arts here at SFU?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think, you know, I think teaching is a feedback loop, you know, and I'm just as interested as learning as my students are. You know, I'm not really the teacher who wants to be at the top of the front of the room saying, like, I know it all, let me share my wisdom with you. But I feel like everything I do is a proposition. And so what I learn, I think, the most from them is that what makes sense to me does not make sense to everybody else. And of course we know this. Like, we know this. We're adults. We know this. And then you go to do something, and then an 18-year-old is like, I don't know what you're on about. Like, this makes zero sense to me, you know? And so I think what I learned, like, this work of processing thought and processing communication around thought, and then also understanding that we all arrive with, my students arrive in the room with a whole bunch of stuff that I know nothing about. Right. And this understanding that they should be able to meet me where I am is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Although I would love it, but, you know, it would make my life be real fast, right? But this is, so I think in the what I learn or how they what they impress upon me is that I have to receive people knowing that I'm trying to say? Like, I can't take for granted that what I say is something digestible, right? Or that it is understood. And so it's put me in this process of having to really, like, break down my practice or how I'd like them to practice with me to sort of these nanobites of information, like bit by bit by bit by bit. Because not only am I facing the training that they received before here, I'm facing the way they grew up or the homes they grew up in or the culture that they're in, that they grew up in. And so, you know, people say, you know, dance is universal. Absolutely, it is universal, but it is not practiced in one way. And just because I danced one way or I've trained in one way, that does not cover all bases, right? And I think there is a little bit of a myopia that happens inside of Western dance forms, which is like, oh, if you can do ballet, you can do anything. This is not true. Right? If you can do contemporary dance, you can do any. Like, no, absolutely not, because they have values and they have hierarchies embedded in them. And then if somebody comes from a culture that those values and those hierarchies aren't there, then there's no way that they can engage with the work you're doing. So I think that teaching is, you know, several bites of humble pie. And then it is also like, can you truly articulate, you know, like they say this when you're writing, like, if you can explain it simply, it means you really know what it is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that I'm learning from them. I'm also learning from them that they actually are in the world in a really, really different way than, like, we're in the same world, but we are in a really different way. So I'm forced constantly, my good friend of mine, Kate Franklin, talks about teaching from the middle, not from the top of the room. And I think this teaching from the middle means that you have to learn how they're in the world. I see this with my kid too, you know, she's 10 and she's living in a different world than I grew up in, for sure, right? So I think that they allow me to process how the work is communicated and how the work is felt, in fact, which I think is our biggest form of communication, right? And so I learn that from them every single day. And some days we find ourselves and we've made a shared language and we totally get what each other's talking about and it's glorious. And then sometimes the next day that falls apart again. So I think they also teach me that inconsistency is just a staple of life.
Yeah.
You know.
I really like how you answered that, because I think that is something that is kind of commonplace within, like, the academic Western art world. Like a struggle, or maybe like a blind spot when it comes to effectively communicating art. You know, I think there are a lot of art spaces, whether it's in Vancouver or any other area of North America, where, you know, an average person can go in and see, like, the writing that describes an exhibit or something and be like, this makes no sense to me. And there's no one there to be like, to, you know, try to meet people halfway. It's kind of like, oh, you don't get it? All right, it's not for you.
Yeah, and this is a tragedy, right? Because in this, there was this wonderful, I'm a part of a committee at FCAT that's run by Chantal Gibson, who's a artist and poet and communications prof. And we run this thing every year called Community in Practice, and this year it was about AI. And the woman who runs the writing center said to us how actually language is like writing is an equity issue. And like it had never occurred to me, which is embarrassing to say, and maybe I shouldn't be saying it so publicly, but this idea that there's a certain kind of writing that communicates in a certain kind of way, and the idea is if you don't get it, you're not allowed in the club, right? And if you can't get down with academic writing, then there's something wrong with you. But we're not asking, is there something wrong with the writing? Right? And I think that's the question that you're bringing up is like, is there something wrong? Because if you didn't read the didactic and you just went in the room and you saw the thing and you had a million feelings and it stayed with you, well, then the art did its thing. But if you read the thing and then you go, I'm not one to read programs or didactics until after I've seen the thing.
Oh,
Because
okay.
sometimes it ruins it for me. Because I like the narrative I had in my head about what I was experiencing, and then I read this other thing and I'm like, well, that wasn't happening, right? So, but I wonder about what kind of language we're using or what kind of language actually we feel we need to use to sound like we deserve our position in that gallery on that stage. I did my MFA. I graduated in 2024, doing my MFA at SFU, at the SCA, and I struggled with the form of academic writing because for me it was a little difficult in the way that it didn't express the values of my work. And I thought, ooh, all of a sudden I have to use this kind of wording, but it doesn't have anything to do with what I'm talking about. So I used footnotes as best I could to like put in the language that I felt needed to be there because I love a footnote. But I thought about that too. I thought, oh, why are we not letting the thing be expressed in the form through words, through language, not the movement part, to reflect what the work is doing and how the work changes a room. And I'm sure there are many brilliant academics who do that. I'm curious about who we leave out when we insist upon, the King's English in a particular form, in a particular order of events. You lay out a thesis and like I always think about, well, what could we use time differently in someone's reading experience? So yeah, and like I need translators for art too. I do. I don't get everything I look at, and I don't always understand what I'm looking at and or what I'm watching. And sometimes those translations do, having a translator of sorts really does help me see, feel, love, enjoy, dislike the work more on either side, right? And then sometimes I'm just left with the feeling of what I saw, which is kind of how I am. Like I'm just like all feeling all the time, but I love that you brought that up because I think if students are listening, like we do need to question those forms, how, and even thinking how AI writes in that form also. And why could it not write in other forms or in other form, like other ways of organizing language?
I mean, it's very embedded, right? So if you have an AI program that's taught on thousands upon millions of words of academic art writing, that's what it's going to regurgitate, essentially.
Exactly. But I even think about like sometimes my dad corrects my grammar in my texts.
Oh, wow,
Yeah.
really?
Every now and then. My dad is a very good writer and loves language and loves books. But every now and then and I'm like, well, it's usually you and I, you and me, or me and this or my child, it's how I use and I or and me. He likes to correct that. And I think, meh, no, the other one was what I meant.
Yeah, the English is very malleable. It's not.
Yeah. I mean, I think about even, yeah, my kid not long ago said to me, I was like, hey, we gotta go, like get your bag, get your coat, get your shoes, get your da-da-da-da-da. And she said to me, Mom, I'm putting the fries in the bag. And I was like, what did you just say? I don't even understand that. And then I was like, then I stopped and I was like, oh, that is such a good expression. Like, I'm almost there. I'm putting the fries in the bag. Like, it's And I just thought, oh, I love the English language, right? Like when we can be that sort of playful with it, I was like, okay. Having a, I don't even know, Gen Alpha. I don't know what my child is. But there's, yeah, these organized. And of course, language, as we know, is meant to change.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like that's how it functions. Words mean one thing at one point in history, and they mean a completely other thing in another point in history, and we've forgotten what they meant before. So this idea that it should be in the state of constant change like everything else, why not, right?
Yeah. Okay, I think I had one last question for this interview, and that was, do you have any, like you had kind of alluded to projects coming on the way, but do you have any specific future plans with the resources that this award has afforded you?
Yeah, I think
you're able to mention at least.
Yeah, I mean, one of my projects is going to the Fierce Festival. Well, the Brutal Joy is going to the Fierce Festival in the UK, which for me was a real bucket list festival that I wanted to be. I wanted to go to for like 10 years, and it invited. We were invited. And this money, should I not get my travel grant, this money will allow us to go even if I don't get a travel grant. And I think that's like, I would have probably happily gone into debt to go and do it there. Also, I found out one of my like dearest friends, Dana Michelle, who's like a really incredible dance artist based in Montreal. She's like, I'm going to Fierce this year. And I was like, I'm going too. So, so I feel like... just knowing I have this cushion that if for some reason, you know, you don't get grant, you're not guaranteed a grant. And this is kind of something I love about grants. You're not guaranteed anything, right? And you're not owed anything. But this means I will still be able to go. So it's a very far trip to the UK when you live in Vancouver. And those are not cheap flights. So I think that's the one for me, to be able to go do that particular work there and know that it can happen even if the grant doesn't come through. Feels... wow. Yeah, it makes me feel incredibly lucky. and I feel like that's a great use of that money. And probably, you know, if the grant comes through, then I'll probably just use it to fund the next thing until I get it together to write a grant. mm-hmm. Yeah.
Once again, that was our conversation with Justine A. Chambers, the winner of the 2025 Viva Award, meant for mid-career visual artists in BC who demonstrate exceptional creative ability and commitment to the visual arts. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This interview would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
This is Bird Note. Some of Hollywood's most iconic beasts owe much of their signature sound to the squawks, tweets, and even hisses of birds. Take Jurassic Park. To create these mournful calls from the Brachiosaurus, sound designer Gary Rydstrom slowed down the honks of geese. In The Prisoner of Azkaban, the hippogriff's scream is actually a limpkin, whose high-pitched call earned it the nickname the Crying Bird. Or in the sci-fi film Arrival. To create the language of the aliens, New Zealand-based sound designers David Whitehead and Michelle Child recorded local birds and lowered their pitch, then added some other animals and instruments like bagpipes and didgeridoos. Ironically, Alfred Hitchcock didn't use any birds for the soundscape of his classic horror film, The Birds. Instead, the sound of those murderous seagulls was made using an early synthesizer called the Trautonium. Hitchcock claimed he couldn't find any real birds that sounded spooky enough. That's Hollywood for you. For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn.